Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, I'm speaking with Anna Teal, CEO of Grown Alchemist. Anna was so much fun to chat to. She was the antithesis of what you might imagine a CEO to be like. And we actually discussed that in the chat, how this stereotypical 90s idea of what a corporate businesswoman should look and act like is actually nothing like the reality, as Anna is a living embodiment of. She shares her fascinating journey from rising through the ranks at Boots to leading innovative beauty brands, including Aromatherapy Associates and now Grown Alchemist. She shares some really brilliant insights on what it's like transitioning from corporate to small business. We also look at how Grown Alchemist is positioning itself as a really strong contender in the biotech beauty space. I really love Anna's refreshingly honest take on personal challenges. She opens up about overcoming public speaking anxiety and the importance of having what she calls your own personal board of directors and why mindset is more important than tactics. Anna and I actually worked together when she was CEO of Aromatherapy Associates, and I helped them revamp their tone of voice and all of their web copies. So that was a really fun project to work together on, and Anna was absolutely lovely. So it's a real joy to be speaking with her again. Let's dive in. Anna, thank you so much for speaking to me today. Now, you've built your career across some iconic beauty brands. So from Boots, Aromatherapy Associates, and now Grown Alchemist. So you've kind of gone from traditional retail to essential oils and now kind of biotech beauty. What's been the most kind of fulfilling for you?
Well, it's great to be on your podcast.
Thank you for joining me.
I think it's difficult to pinpoint it to any one thing, because I've always felt very fortunate that I found a career pathway quite early in my career in an industry that I've absolutely adored. And I've always said that if you find something that you're very passionate about personally and interested in, the lines of work in your life and who you are get blurred. And I've definitely found that through my career journey and in the brands that I've ended up subsequently running, is that they've all personally resonated with me for one reason or another. And therefore, some of the things that you've been managing to implement can then make you feel hugely proud. If I think back to Boots, I started just after 18, having finished my A-levels. And at the time, Boots was my favourite shop. So for me, to be able to work at my favourite shop and get makeup at a discount or for free was just literally the dream. But I also had a fantastic learning journey and had some of the best people in the industry training me in the discipline of the business of beauty. In Aromatherapy Associates, what I found was real joy in creating products and leading a brand that I really genuinely felt helped people through stressful times and helped people sleep better. And our, you know, customer testimonials that we would get would definitely reflect that. And that was hugely rewarding and enriching. And the team were just fabulous there. And here at Grown Alchemist, to be able to be part of the brand's growth journey in a more modern space for skincare and really helping to champion the best of science with then the potency of natural actives and the impact that that can have on your total skin health feels very exciting in a very different way. So, but underpinning all of that is just, I've just always had a passion for beauty and wellness. And so I just feel personal enrichment from all of those roles that I've had.
Amazing. And I love what you're doing with Grown Alchemist. I mean, we'll come to that in a minute. But just to go back to your time at Boots, I mean, I've met quite a few sort of amazing people who are kind of Boots alumni. Do you think that company is very good at like nurturing their talent? I mean, I assume that you started on the shop floor and then went from there.
I didn't actually start on the shop floor, interestingly. You had to have, when I joined in the late 90s, early noughties, it was an exceptional time to be part of the Boots team. And a lot of the alumni that I'm sure you'll be referencing would have been in and around kind of that decade or that era where just exceptional training from incredible people. And so whether that was training in the art of like good retailing and acute focus on giving the customer something different and more than what they expected. It was a time in Boots where they were really championing differentiation and innovation, and really supported and felt proud of the Boots brand and the Boots product brand. And so you always had that broader remit of how do you develop a product proposition, as well as how do you work with suppliers to really give them a fantastic assortment and service to choose from. And it was a very nurturing time. I was incredibly fortunate to go on a number of different development programs. I had the benefit, as I know other people did, to have fantastic leadership to help you grow as people, as leaders. And go on some of their development programs. And so my time at Boots is filled with nothing but respect for that company and for gratitude for the learning journey that it placed me on. And I was very lucky to be at the company at a time where they were doing really cool things, developing new categories like democratizing professional hair care and working with really cool hairdresser brands to create new brand propositions. It was a hugely exciting and rewarding part of my career.
And I remember when we were chatting before, you saying that you wanted a role where you wanted to have sort of a bit more ownership and really take on like a leadership role. And you felt like in Boots, there just wasn't the infrastructure and the framework for you to do the kind of role that you wanted to do, and hence the move to Aromatherapy Associates. Is that accurately
So
put?
I was, yeah, ha having worked through different retail and branded roles. So I did 12 years in Boots retailing. I ran most categories of some sort that you'd see in the beauty area. Then I was asked to move into the branded team to help set up a pipeline of new brands, whether that was through licensing, and eventually that went into mergers and acquisitions. And over that time and that journey, and particularly having worked with other entrepreneurs and brand founders, I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed, I'd been, I'd led hundreds of million dollar categories, but I really enjoyed the hustle and the focus and the dedication that nurturing and growing a brand and a business required. And through my own development journey, I decided I just wanted to be seen as a businesswoman. And therefore, I wanted to run a business. Now, there's nothing wrong with the Boots structure because it's right for that organization. But you ran a category, and then you'd work with subject matter experts in finance and in operations and supply chain to develop your end-to-end offer. And I really wanted to have a go at running my own business end-to-end. And there just weren't many in the group. So I think there's still to this day that I can think of Boots Hair and Care, maybe Boots Opticians, Boots Island that are run as separate businesses. And so when I was talking about my career pathway with my boss at the time, and I shared that, he was like, "Well, there's not that many options for you. These are the ones, or there's Boots Thailand if you want to go abroad." But then Aromatherapy Associates came up because they were a co-investor with a private equity firm, and I knew about the brand and had a huge affinity for it. So jumped at the chance, actually never thinking that I'd end up in a role where I had the job title CEO, actually. I'd not really thought that far ahead because I was thinking about the characteristics of the job that I wanted, and I just knew I wanted to run a business. And so gave that a go and spent just under 5 years with that team.
And I imagine it was just a very different kind of environment to being in Boots. I mean, I know we've spoken before about coming from a corporate background and then sort of joining an independent brand, and how different it is. I mean, what was that like for you?
It's so different, and I think it's so different, and they're both rewarding in different ways. In a larger corporate organization, it's a more structured way of working. You have your remit, you then have world-class people that are subject matter experts in their area, and you draw on them so that you can do your job well. You go into a smaller, particularly a smaller business, You have to, rather than have depth, you really need to demonstrate breadth of understanding of all the different kind of cogs in the machine that are going forward. And it's a much more emotional ride because you're starting to think all of a sudden about cash flow and balance sheet and how much stock you've got on hand. Whereas in a large scale organization, you've got other people thinking about that for you. It's traditionally you manage your P&L rather than the balance sheet. Whereas in a smaller company, any founder I'm sure that you've spoken to will tell you, have I got enough cash in the bank to keep going? And how much of my cash is taken up with stock? And have I got enough stock? And
Someone
so
described it
it's
as like flying a plane while you're still building it, but you're
it
already up in the
completely
air.
that is a perfect description. And do you know what? Internally in our team, we do use that a lot. And it's a more of an emotional roller coaster, I think, because it just feels much more personal to you. You celebrate the highs, you experience the lows much more acutely as well. So it's very different. And it's very different when you're recruiting people as well, in terms of what you might want to look for, which has been a real learning for me. When I was trying to recruit people in aromatherapy associates, and I've been, and actually even at Grown Alchemist now, when I speak to other founders, saying sometimes you get to that stage, you go, oh, I just need a great L'Oreal person because I know that they're great at what they, their training to help get the company to the next stage. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't because of what I described before, where they used to go, yeah, but I'm used to someone writing that presentation for me. I don't do presentations in this job. Someone in marketing went, well, that person doesn't exist, so you are now, sorry, and you don't have an insights team, so you're going to have to mine creatively your own insights to make the pack work. So it is quite a different skill set, and some people really flourish and thrive in that environment, and some people find it's not for them because what they enjoy is that larger scale corporate environment. So you have to really give that some thought when you're trying to bring the right talent in. And sometimes you've got someone that knocks it out of the park, that's got the background and knowing, how larger brands work, but know how to apply that appropriately to a smaller environment. And then you've struck gold if you can find
Yeah.
that.
It's similar to your own journey from going from Boots and then going to taking the helm at Aromatherapy Associates. I mean, do you think you need to be a certain type of person to sort of fit into that role, or certain characteristics, would you say?
I'd probably say emotionally committed to work in a small company, like really emotionally invested. And I feel this about Grown Alchemist and Aromatherapy Associates. I felt like they were mine. And I run the business as if it's that fully mine. And I always say to the team, if it was your mortgage on the line, would you be spending that dollar in that way? And that's the psyche that you've got to have. And you have to, it's that emotion and that kind of intellectual kind of debate. So do I think I'm clever enough to kind of, most people have got the intellectual capacity to run a company. But sometimes it's that just genuine drive to succeed in a really, it's a saturated marketplace, discerning customers, more knowledgeable customers than ever because of social media and
For sure.
the information that's available. And so you have to really fight for the customer's attention, and that takes a lot of graft, sometimes a bit of hustle, and a real determination that actually probably goes beyond any job description. And so one of the filters is if I have somebody that keeps talking to me about job descriptions or organizational structure, they're probably not the ideal people for a fast-growing smaller company because you just have to get on with it and work as a team to get the jobs done.
For sure, and you have to be sort of creative and be prepared to like roll your sleeves up and do stuff across all the different.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, does that sometimes become an issue where there's people chiming in on everything, and people are like, well, you're now that this is my, this is my area of expertise, because I've had that myself. Like, I'm just talking from my own personal experience with smaller brands. It can be like, well, Bob in accounts thinks this. I'm like, well, I'm the copywriter, so it's like.
Yeah, and it does happen all the time, and it happens at a Grown Alchemist. I'd be lying if I didn't say, if it didn't, and we're constantly having to calibrate to go, look, if you trust your team colleagues and you know where you need to get the brand to, I think some of those intellectual debates around, the copywriting example, it's going, thanks, but I'm still going to run with it. And actually, and this is a conversation that I've had in the past with my team, is don't let, perfection get in the way of great. Because the time that you might waste debating whether the copy is right or not, or perfecting it to make it perfect, you could miss the moment. And actually, more crucially, the customer will tell you. The customer is the ultimate metric. And as long as you're constantly quickly learning and refining, that for me is better than having constant internal debate. Just get on with it, just keep learning, because the customer will tell you what works and doesn't work. And quite often, if you look at different case studies of different brands when they've gone viral, it's been something that's happened by chance. It's not been the intellectually thought through fantastic copy that's
Yeah,
just
it's that lightning in a bottle moment, isn't it? Done is better than perfect, right?
That's on me as the leader to kind of help create that freedom for people to innovate and to flourish in, but with kind of, I guess, that structured framework to have the right checkpoints.
That's a really smart way of going about it. And you've sort of completely repositioned Grown Alchemist from like just being sort of a clean beauty brand, and now it's more like a sort of biological beauty brand for the design conscious. So it's a complete narrative shift. I mean, how do you kind of craft that story without alienating the current consumer?
I think I wouldn't say it's a fundamental repositioning. I think it's a refinement that's representative of a few things. Is how the founding principle was always to see your skin health, and optimizing your skin is a 360 approach. So that has always been there from the founder's story, and I would never want to take that away from them. But how that was administered has evolved, and that's just because technology is evolving. We're in a wonderful era where we've got fabulous labs, better testing protocols, and we really wanted to have to keep to that original ethos, actually, around are we putting the right products in that can help optimize the way that the skin absorbs them. And using biotech just really helps us with that, because we can be much more focused on the part of the botanical, the extract that we're using. And we've put all of our formulations, the new formulations, through clinicals and customer testing, so we can validate it scientifically, and quantify what customers' responses are for it. The aesthetic has always been there. What we've tried to do in the brand strategy is just start to codify what we describe as codifying its importance to the brand. So there's a little bit around you buy it because it works, and you buy it because you just love it on your shelf, right? And actually, it's an acknowledgement that both of those are important. And so we kind of say it's what you see and what we do. What we do is now do great bioactive and biotech formulations, and what we do is we deliver that in a beautiful way for you aesthetically, so you can be proud as how it appears in your home.
You've had some amazing partnerships recently. I mean, that's really a big thing for you guys, right? In that.
And it's central to our strategy, because we did some consumer research and we've done personas. So in the marketing world, it'll be quite a common terminology. So you do your consumer insights, so you go beyond the demographics of male, female, age group into actually, what are their passion points and interests? And so we know that there are certain passion points and interests in fitness and in music and in travel that we know really resonates with our customer. And so we'll continue to partner in those consumer resonance spaces, because it's just a really nice, authentic way to introduce our product to those people. And it's great, like, I guess, sampling, and we can move then into experiential marketing as well, which is the other thing that we want to do, is not just have 100% of our marketing owned by this because of this. It's
Yes, exactly.
how do you get people to be really immersed in the product and the stories that you're trying to tell?
So partnerships is I think it's a really great way of approaching demographics as opposed to those kind of typical categories where, oh, she's a certain age and she lives here and
Completely. Yeah, because that's all changing now as well, right? So, you know, the definition of what it is to be, say, 50 or 55 now is very different to what it was, say, 15 years ago, in terms of how people are living their life and the types of experiences that they're giving themselves and therefore the products that they want to use. So, yeah.
And I love that how simplistic your messaging in sort of messaging is, like health, function, beauty. I mean, how do you convey the more sophisticated aspects of biotech while wanting to keep that messaging concise and digestible for the customer?
It's not easy. And I'd say that we're still learning, we're still refining that. And I think it depends on where you want to relay it because you can do a blog, customers got a bit more time, more receptive to something that's slightly longer form as a narrative. And so we might go a bit deeper into meet one of our latest ingredients, ashwagandha or ectoin or snow mushroom. This is a breakdown of what it does for you and why we use it in our products and find it in products X, Y, and Z. If you're on a website, you've literally got like 2 seconds to capture the imagination of the customer. And so it tends to be more visual format. So product or visual of the ingredient, stat, this does this. I call it the cat sat on mat approach to kind of just tell them what it does. Just, you know, just make it really simple. And that may be where we then say, you know, improves skin barrier strength by 30% in 12 hours, which is, you know, one of the claims, one of our serums, or 95% of customers felt their skin was smoother and healthier after one use. So that's where you may put some of the validation behind it. So it just depends on the audience and the format. And like I've said, we're still trying to get sharper on that ourselves, actually.
Yes, I think the core principle is just keep it simple, isn't it? Rather
Yeah.
than get.
Simple, understandable. Yeah. It's not, don't over intellectualize it because that's not, you know, that's not what the customer necessarily wants. They just want to know that they're buying something that's worth their money and that's going to help them.
And do you think biotech beauty is here, definitely here to stay? Where do you see it headed? Because it's obviously a huge deal at the moment, and a lot of people are talking about it.
Yeah, I definitely do for a number of reasons. One, it broadens out your ingredient platform. The second is it just helps from an environmental perspective in this, and it's a sustainability perspective in the sense that you're not then wholly dependent on crops and how well the crop has grown and the variability that you can get in the quality of the crop if a crop has failed or the weather hasn't been in your favor. And there's just so much investment that's happening in that space. It will just enable formats and textures to be created, which I think the customer will enjoy. So I think there's a combination of different reasons around the breadth that you have on offer, the sustainability aspect, but then also what it enables you to do from an innovation perspective.
Exactly, because you still need to be competitive, right? Although as much as you want to be sustainable, you still need to be, having that results-driven element to the products.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this whole is, I mean, I personally don't like the word clean in beauty because the inference is that everything else is dirty, and I
For
don't
sure.
believe that that is the case. I've always believed in the power of nature and that much of the sources that are in nature combined with science to deliver fantastic products and services. And ultimately, that's what Aromatherapy Associates also stood for, is, you know, harnessing the potency of nature through essential oils. But yeah, I think there is so much more innovation and momentum that will continue to be championed and in different formats. You know, we're now talking about mushroom powders and ingestibles and increasing knowledge in terms of how that helps with mental focus. And we have our partnership with Revive, which is the IV drip provider, and we have two trademarked and unique complexes that we know can help with skin health and hair follicle kind of health and hair growth as a result of that. So people will continue to expand in these spaces as technology continues to evolve. And for me, the comment that you're making earlier around, you know, sustainability, I feel it's becoming more and more of a hygiene factor now, as it should. And so I just think that brands have a responsibility of having recycled and recyclable packaging or no microplastics and cruelty-free formulations, because why would you have them in today's world?
So by
It's
hygiene,
almost,
you mean it should be part of the blueprint. It shouldn't be
yeah, it's not the
pat on the
thing
back
anymore, is
moment.
my point. Yeah, it's not the thing anymore. And
No.
so a few years ago, and 10, 20 years ago, it was the main call out. I just don't think it's enough in the eyes of the customer. They'd be just like,
No.
and yeah, that's of course I expect that. Yeah, and then what? And what else are you
Exactly.
doing? And so, and I suspect that that may be one of the reasons why brands like Rent, ended up where they were, because it never kind of moved on enough to
No.
maintain its relevancy.
Exactly. And you have a really impressive male market. I believe it's 40% male
Yeah, it's
customers.
yeah,
Which is like
it's.
the, I think the male market is the holy grail for so many beauty brands because they are statistically very brand loyal. How do you create messaging that appeals to everyone without falling into that kind of gender neutral blandness?
Well, I think the design aesthetic helps, and the packaging that we have gives it a much more universal appeal. The model imagery that we use, we definitely hope feels representative of the consumer audience that we have as well. And so if you can see yourself in the imagery, then you're more likely to buy. So we're always very careful that we have models that we feel is genuinely representative of the people that we feel that we serve. And then it does, by and large, comes down to the product formats and the kits and the sets and where you make your products available ultimately. I actually feel that we could do more in the men's skincare kind of market, catering for men and actually target them a little bit more than we have been recently. Because I think it's a fantastic sector and it's great to see it growing and it's great to see, other facets like male makeup kind of coming
For sure.
as well and growing in that space. And so it's, I can't say beyond, we try to be as representative in the narrative, the products that we've developed, so that people can find something that is genuinely for them and their skin type. As well as making sure that the images that they see, they feel that it is a brand for them.
Yes, definitely. I think there's loads of like untapped opportunities in the male market for sure. There's a section that questions that I like to ask on this podcast, just about sort of personal challenges that people have overcome when building their career and building a business. What were the biggest challenges you would say that you encountered on a personal level in terms of like mental block career?
I think there's a few. I think the first was that I just try not to overthink it. Like being paralyzed with indecision is worse than making a decision. Kind of goes back to the earlier point that I made around, don't let great get in the way of good. Just if it's good enough, just get it out because you'll learn. And it's almost like the flip of that is, what's the worst that could happen? And sometimes in my earlier career, the fear of getting it wrong would get in the way of me just getting on with it. And so I had to kind of get to the stage of then, what's the worst that can happen? What is genuinely the worst that can happen if you did this and it didn't go right? It's
Exactly.
like, because not doing it is surely going to be worse than not doing something at all. And that took a while, because particularly if you're in a big corporate kind of, you've got a lot of eyes kind of on you, lots of discussions around are people, great at their job, and that kind of, ongoing performance management culture where you do benchmarking at certain levels. I felt that pressure to always be at the top of my game. And so that didn't always bring out the best in my own thinking. And I was really lucky that I had some great mentors and coaches. And one of them said something to me once, was, Anna, you've got, you're very professional, you run businesses, you spearhead very complicated projects, and you always set up your team to kind of based on what you need to get that job done. And she said, think about your own development and support network as you create your own personal board. So have a think about who's on your personal board of directors for you. So who's the friend that you're going to ring up that's going to give you some counsel in this space that you know's got your back, is a whiz at this, or you can phone someone up to get counsel in this other space so that you feel that you're equipped with your own support network. And it was such a good piece of advice. Just knowing who you can call out to help you with that if you do get a mental block. And I found that incredibly enriching and helpful for me personally. And then the second is this public speaking thing. And when I was in a more corporate role, I was doing it. I was expected to present to senior people quite a lot at different stages
Yes.
of that. And that could be big set piece presentation on a piece of work or an update to some very senior executives, or sometimes it would be having a town hall and you're asked to be a guest speaker to talk about a topic. Well, if I knew I had one of those coming up, I would be awake from about 3 o'clock in the morning, like going over and over and over in my head. What am I going to say? Something's going to go wrong. They're going to think about this. Oh my God, it's going to be terrible. So by the time I was actually getting out of bed by about 7:30 in the morning, one, I was shattered. And the second is I probably memorized to death everything that I was trying to say to the point of paralysis. So I was doing myself no favors because I'd go intense. People could see that in me, and I probably wasn't coming across as relatable because I'd be just sat there like I need to get
I've
this
had that,
message
yeah. You
out,
end up
and
just
then I'm
motoring
gonna
through it,
go,
like,
yeah, you almost become like robotic,
yeah, your brain's like, let's just get this
rather
over with
than,
and get out of here so then we don't have
yeah,
to, like.
rather than having a conversation with people, whether it's the audience or the people that's in the room. And so it became a really big thing for me. And so I had a leader at the time that was, that was a fantastic at public speaking. So I ended up spending a lot of time observing him, asking his advice, so this personal board thing. I wrote quite a few of his presentations so I could see what he was doing that was different to what I was doing. Because I was writing his presentations, I knew what notes he was or wasn't doing, and actually how he was entering into those presentation formats with very little script, but he knew the message he wanted to relay. Now, this we're not talking about, a listed company giving out financial results, which has to be scripted because you
For
have to be
sure.
very precise. This is about
You can't really wing it with that.
this is about, engaging people. And so having like started to equip myself with a bit of a toolkit to help me, I then just started to force myself into certain situations to go, right, you are consciously now going to present in this forum, but practice this. So practice your body language, practice that you're going to tell a bit of a story before you get into the subject to make it feel relatable and personal about you. What's the story that you want to tell? And it actually meant that I had to think about how to present in a slightly different way. And then over time, even though sometimes people won't want to hear this, you chill out a bit just from just having gone through it a few times, and you've realized that it's not been the end of the world, and actually you felt pretty good in one of those situations doing it. So I wouldn't say I'm the strongest public speaker, but I know for sure that I don't wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning anymore over intellectualizing it. My prep comes earlier in terms of what do I want people to feel, what's the impact that I want to have on them, rather than what is the intellectual content that I've got to impart. It's a
Exactly.
slightly different nuance that I approach it from now.
Yeah, I don't know what it is that is so terrifying, because I'm like you, I've had hypnotherapy for it, I've done like tapping therapy, and I can just about manage it, but I'm still like, yeah, not perfect by any means. But yeah, I'm just not sure why the prospect of it is so terrifying. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? But it is for some reason.
Yeah, well, and I think, look, people, I think the more you internalize it, the harder it becomes because you're making it more and more and more about you. And I think the other thing that helped me was just let it go. Actually, all of those people are thinking about them. So,
Yes.
like, yeah, so you're making it like in your mind 80% about you. They're going to hate me. They're going to not listen to. They're going to think it's rubbish. All me, 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 me. Whereas if you're thinking, well, how can I try and help impart something to them? Because ultimately they're thinking about themselves. It's quite liberating kind of to think of it in that way, because
Yes.
the chances are they'll walk out the room and not think about that presentation again, and in the same way that you would.
No, exactly. It's really sort of easy to get fall into that trap though, isn't it? Of just being so worried about everyone's just sort of like got their pens out and like judging you and being like scrutinizing you, and it's actually not as, yeah, like I say, they've all got their own stuff going on, haven't they? And it is a case of just, if you do it enough times, then your nervous system realizes that it's safe and that it's not this
Exactly,
terrifying
exactly that.
prospect. I mean, when it comes to like women in leadership roles, I know there's a huge emphasis at the moment on kind of work-life balance and getting rid of the hustle and embracing that kind of softer life. I mean, where do you think that leaves kind of women in business? Because obviously it's very different messaging, it feels like, at the moment to what we heard growing up about, yeah, you need to take on these challenges and work really hard and take on these kind of big scary roles. I mean, do you think that there is still, do you think there's still a case for that women should be pursuing these kind of leadership roles?
I do, and I'd hope that actually that message does continue. That it's like I try and, even though there is still a gender disparity and a pay gap and everything else, if you look at the statistics, I try to take the gender out of it as best as I can, because I was a working mum. I had my children very, very young, and so I've had my whole, like a lot of my working career with the juggle of being a wife, a mum, and being a professional. And it's not easy. So the first thing that I'd say is, you're not always going to get it right. The golden trio of work, family, friends, at least one of those is going to be off par. At least you're like 10 out of 10 on all three. I'm like, I don't know anyone that does that, like running on all three cylinders,
No,
like,
no one has the
oh well.
bandwidth, right?
There's You have to make choices and compromises as to go, do you know what, this week I've got to just go all in on work, and so I'm just not going to be around as much for the family, but the following week I am. And it's then about the rhythm of that you get into over time. And I could not have done my job without my husband. There's just no like two ways about it. And having the support for him to want to see me succeed. This concept of a traditional 1990 professional high heel wearing mini skirt kind of ball breaker, I would hope now that by and large people don't see that you have to be that persona to be
No.
successful. I think there are a plethora of very modern, highly successful, aspirational business women that don't embody that. What they embody is focus. What they embody is love what you do. What they embody is know that you're never going to be perfect 100% of the time. What they embody is that you have to work incredibly hard to be successful at anything. Like, whether it's work or, you decide to do like a passion in the arts or something, if that's your choice. You don't get to excellence by not putting the time in. And so I think managing then a professional role with a parenting role, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. You become much more discerning around where you're going to allocate your time, and you become much more balanced in I guess, you can't get that job done, so that is going to have to wait because you've got to focus on something here. And I actually found it hugely enriching. Not easy, but I found it hugely enriching. And actually, all the points that you said, I felt I did experience. I was much more clear around, right, I've got to get this done. That's not going to be worth my time this week. I'm going to get that done because I've then got to, go home and do sports day.
And I think
So,
it's great for your, I'm sure your kids really look up to you and they see like you doing
well,
this
you'd
great
think.
stuff and
Yeah, I've got teenagers. So
they might not admit it and
they're
being,
great.
being
Yeah, but they
teenagers,
are
but
great, and they're great people. And I'm always very proud to say that, they've grown up in an environment where they can see they've got parents that are working, and we've always tried to teach them that just find something that you love, but be excellent at it.
that kind of mindset piece is just as important as the tactics, would you agree?
Mindset is, for me, mindset is more important than tactics, because you can be you can be the brainiest person in the room intellectually that's come from Harvard or Oxford or Cambridge. You've not got the commercial nous or the drive to turn that into action and uncover opportunities, you will not be successful. You're the academic in the room. There is like it's the mentality, like for me, is everything.
No, I
Some of
agree.
my most junior people in the team that are technically the least qualified in the office are generating some of our best results because they're uncovering the opportunities. They're going, I just need to
Yeah.
get my win. I need to get my little hustle on. And I'm like going, yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Anna, thank you so much for chatting with me. Really
My
appreciate it. Really
pleasure.
lovely to have you on the show.
Well, thank you again.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.